It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin lawmakers are still working on their budget priorities for public education. A school district superintendent joins us for a look at the needs of K-12 schools. Now it's Food Friday. Our next guest loved to cook, and then he couldn't. Developing pain condition took him out of the kitchen, and he's not alone. For people with disabilities, chronic conditions, long-term illnesses, the impacts of aging, and more, the kitchen can be a much more challenging and less joyful space. But in a new book, our guest says he found ways to get back into cooking and shares lots of advice learned along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does this sound like your story or a family member, friend, someone you're close to? How does living with a disability or other mobility issue, say, impact what you eat, how you prepare meals for yourself or others? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jules Sherrod is an author, writer, and food photographer based in British Columbia. His new book is called Crip Up the Kitchen, Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. Jules, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I summed up your story very briefly there. Can you talk a little more about your love of cooking, the joy of cooking, and why it was important for you to recapture that feeling?
I grew up in a family where food and cooking was always central, especially around family gatherings and community. I grew up in a lot of communities, especially communities of new Canadians who brought their very heavy food cultures with them when they came to Canada and was really immersed in that. And so cooking was always a very central part to my life growing up. And then I became disabled in my early 20s, but it progressed to the point where cooking was pretty much cut out of my life for a good 5 years. I couldn't do it at all. It was torture. It was excruciating. And it wasn't until I found tips and tools to be able to start reclaiming that part of my life that I realized how much missing it was an issue. Like I had this gray cloud over my life, or in my brain, so to speak. It wasn't quite a depression, but it was still like everything was dull is the best way I can describe it. And I didn't realize how much part of my soul was dimmed until I was able to reclaim the ability to cook. So it was huge for me, absolutely phenomenal. And as I started to develop recipes with disability in mind and be able to reconnect with certain recipes that were so important to me personally and felt that joy, then it became a bit of a mission to be able to give people that joy too, who where food is so central, not just for like having to eat and stay alive, but also for a mental health reason.
And here's a line that really struck me. The kitchen is the worst room in the house if you are disabled. Can you talk about that a little?
So if you become disabled, it can cost up to $100,000 to do a renovation in the kitchen to make it accessible, because it's not cheap to lower counters, as an example. It's not cheap to widen the clearance between, say, the fridge and the counter if you're a wheelchair user. None of those things are cheap. Other rooms are much more financially feasible to update, like putting a shower rail or whatever, having aids to be able to get out of bed or whatever. All that stuff is, I mean, it's not cheap overall, but it is far more inexpensive than having to make a kitchen accessible. And even kitchens that do have the like new building codes have, I think it's like 3 feet or 2.5 feet from the fridge to the counter. But a lot of that time, that clearance is not enough to fit a wheelchair between that and still being able to open up the fridge, or fit a wheelchair safely and being able to open up an oven. Think like all this stuff is by default not designed with disability in mind.
Now, if there is a star of your book, apart from you, Jules, it is the electric pressure cooker, the Instant Pots and other brands in the world. Why, and most of your recipes in the book center around this, why is this such a key tool?
Because of its ease of use and the fact that it doesn't matter what form of disability you have, you just throw a bunch of ingredients into the Instapot, you set the time, and you forget about it. You don't have to worry about forgetting what you're doing if you have any type of brain fog or working memory issues. You don't have to worry about forgetting what you're cooking and burning. You don't have to worry about fatigue. You don't have to worry about standing up. You can use the kitchen room in any room in your house, or the Instapot in any room of the house. So if you needed to sit down and cook in your living room, you could do that at your couch, as long as you have an extension cord to be able to plug it in. It's very, very versatile and just friendly to you if you know how to use it. That's the biggest stumbling block, is learning how to use it. But once you know how to use it, then you're set for life.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Jules Sherrod about the new book, Crip Up the Kitchen: Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you need some advice? Do you have some advice to share about cooking with having a particular disability or chronic condition or something that's changed in your cooking as you've aged, maybe? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jules, an interesting part of the cooking planning you talk about is fatigue management. And while disabilities are going to be different from person to person, it's a very common story for people that, you know, you've got a finite amount of energy. Spoons is the example you give. Can you talk about managing our energy spoons and how that factors into cooking?
Yeah, so whether it be a chronic illness, disability, or a pain issue, but even people who are neurodivergent, thinking is very exhausting. So exhausting. Masking, if you're neurodivergent, is exhausting. A lot of people with disabilities, one of their major shared symptoms is chronic fatigue. And people who are able-bodied have cups of energy they can spend throughout the day, and it takes no effort to replenish that cup. Those of us where fatigue is one of our main symptoms of our disability, we have spoonfuls of energy that we can spend, and it takes a lot more effort to be able to replenish those spoons. And sometimes it can take a week just to replenish one spoon. So we have to be very mindful with how we use our energy. So I have created a system where you create a chart of activities that you're able to accomplish based off of how many spoons you have. And it takes a while to be able to create a chart that works for you. And I give a chart in the cookbook as an example to work from, as a jumping off point. And so my suggestion is that people, in the beginning of their day, they assess their body, they figure out how many spoons they have, and then they pick activities based off of that number. They reassess in the afternoon after lunch. And if they are down to one spoon, then they are done. If they have some more spoons to spend, then they can add some more activities. The goal at the end of your day, when you reassess a third time, is to have one spoon left at least, so that you can enjoy the evening and that you're not dying and crashing on the couch once your work day is over. So you have things other than to do other than work. And so the whole concept is to work within your limitations, to recognize that we all have limitations, and that is cool. And you actually end up being more productive when you work within those boundaries, instead of pushing yourself to the point where you're getting injured and to the point where you're having to spend a week in bed because you did too much. And then all the recipes are organized based off of that concept. So the very first recipe takes the least amount of energy and spoons to make, and it's all the way through to the very last recipe, which takes every single ounce of energy you have. And you do that when you have like a very extra burst of energy and you want to do something very special. And most of the recipes fall into like low effort, low energy category.
Let's visit one of those recipes. You shared a few with us. We've got them at WPR.org/Food Friday, an electric pressure cooker butter chicken. Can you tell us a little bit about that recipe?
So butter chicken is a recipe that is relatively new to Indian cuisine. I have the food history to that in the book as well. And a lot of people think it's like a really old dish, and it's not. But the reason why I have it in the book is because it teaches the very basic technique for cooking a curry, and a curry is actually a cooking method and not a flavor. And that's another thing that I explain in the book. Curry means to cook in a gravy. It's often a masala gravy, which means a spicy gravy, but it doesn't have to be a masala-based gravy. And so it teaches the basics of cooking a curried dish, so that you can any other curry that you want to do, you can use the method for those other curries as well. Once you learn one curry, you basically know how to make all the curries. There's just a method or a matter of changing up the spice blends and the ingredients. And it's a favorite, right? Like, who doesn't love butter chicken? And it's like 10 minutes of effort and it's done, compared to if you were doing butter chicken in a traditional method, traditional being in like air quotes, which you can't see, which can take hours. So it's just one of those things to really show, like, you can have this delicious dish, 10 minutes, done. And you also learn how to make other curries in the process.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to author and food photographer Jules Sherrod about his new book, Crip Up the Kitchen: Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? Have you been using one of the devices we've highlighted so far? We've talked about the electric pressure cooker in particular. Do you find that simplifies your cooking? If you have a disability or something else that makes life more difficult for you in the kitchen, have you found solutions, workarounds? Do you need some advice for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with author and food photographer Jules Sherrod. We're talking about his new book called Crip Up the Kitchen: Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. If we're talking about you and your experience in the kitchen, would love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're busy cooking, of course, that's just fine. But the number is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jules, you talk some about, you know, setting up the kitchen in convenient ways to make the flow a little better, you know, short of that $100,000 renovation that you're talking about, that obviously that is not really an option for a lot of us. What are some of your key pieces of advice?
If you have an area in your kitchen that will fit a table, it doesn't have to be a huge table, any size table that is good, prepare food at a table. You can even do this in your dining room as well if you want to use your dining room for something other than primarily an eating room. I mean, a lot of families do that now. So have a working table. That's what kitchen tables used to be used for. And your often used appliances and tools and spices you keep on that table right in front of you. It's all about making sure that things are you don't have to go hunting for tools and pulling things out, which again expends energy and can increase pain levels. You can have like extra carts and stuff beside you or directly behind you, all within arm's reach to put things that won't fit on that table. You don't put things away that are you are using often, and a lot of people will be like, well, that's cluttered. I'm like, no, like, this is about making sure that your kitchen works for you and that you are not hurting yourself working in your kitchen. So that's my biggest tip, is just create a work area wherever you are able to do that has those most often used tools and staple, like shelf-safe ingredients at reach.
You also have an approach in the book to meal planning, Jules, and you, I think, had the same reaction to some of the meal planning advice out there. It's like, you know, it doesn't seem like it's that much less work the way these people want us to do it. You've got a different method. Could you share that with us?
Yeah, and every time I talk about this, people are like, "Are you daft?" I'm like, "No, trust me, it works." So I look at meal planning at a month in advance, and automatically people are like, "Come on now, a month?" I'm like, "Yes, it's really easy if you just take an extra like 10, 15 minutes to kind of plan. You pick 8 to 9 recipes that your favorite recipes that you know that no matter how you're feeling, you will like safe foods, recipes that you know you will enjoy. And then you figure out what those staple ingredients are, like the big ingredients are for those recipes. And you spend time every 2 weeks chopping those recipes in the quantities that they're used. And then you freeze them and you pull them out. When you need to, and you, with the Instapot, that's another great thing is you can cook things from frozen. You just need to add a couple more minutes to the time under pressure. Super, super easy. And it's also any recipes that call for like half of something, double that recipe. So that like all of my fridge always has like 8 containers of 1 cup of onions, which is like 1 medium onion. And so like any recipe that I've ever come across that says use half an onion or half a cup of onion, I'm like, no, it's going, I'm doubling the recipe and doing 1 cup. So I'm not freezing ingredients in different sizes. It's all standardized. There's no thinking. And then I always have prepared ingredients on hand in a way that's not going to end up in compost because I've gone bad in my fridge because I just don't have the energy to cook. And if I am feeling with like I have extra energy, then I always have something ready to go. And also doing batch cooking is another big thing. Like I never make something that's only going to be enough for one meal. It's like 8 canned, like pressure jarred food can that go in my cupboards. So I also always have prepared meals ready to go in my pantry.
Talking to Jules Sherrod on Food Friday. His new book is Crip Up the Kitchen: Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. I've got a few recipes from Jules at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's check out, Jules, another one of those. Now, you a lot of these have personal stories. This one I love. It's one of your church basement memories, the electric pressure cooker hamburger stew.
So I love the story of this one. And this is like a medium effort recipe because it takes quite a while to chop all the vegetables that are in it. So I grew up in the United Church of Canada, and there's a women's group called the United Church Women, UCW, that every year put out cookbooks for congregations across Canada to purchase, and that money would go to fund their local church. And people would submit recipes to it. And there were always multiple recipes. Normally, most of them would all come from the province of Saskatchewan for hamburger soup or hamburger stew. And they were all slightly different in different ways. And then I had to, like, it really stuck out to me, like, what is with Saskatchewan and hamburger stew or hamburger soup? And when I did some research, it has to do with the Dust Bowl. Dust Bowl and the Great Depression, and a time where they did not have people did not have means, especially farmers. So Saskatchewan is a farm province, and they suffered greatly during the Dust Bowl. And it was something that was cheap and nutritious that they could still feed their families with, even throughout that time. And so that's included in there as well. It's very versatile. And you can add whatever veg that you like to it. You can change up the meat from hamburger to like a meatless, like Beyond Meat, or you can even use like chicken or turkey if you wanted to, if you're not, if hamburger isn't your thing. And so yeah, it's just really delicious and versatile.
Again, you can find that recipe linked at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, Jules, your book is filled with electric pressure cooker type recipes. There are cookbooks out there. What if people have that favorite thing that they used to make in the oven? Is it pretty easy to convert and make that in an Instant Pot or other brand pressure cooker meal?
Yes, and I have a guide in the cookbook how to do both. How to so with things like in the oven, you can even do cakes in the Instant Pot. You just would put a cake pan on a trivet, put a cup of water to create the steam so it goes under pressure. It makes a very dense, moist cake. But I also have a cake recipe to use in the air fryer to give an example of how you can do cakes in the air fryer. But you can also use your bread machine to make cakes. And I have bread machine recipes as well with cakes. For if you have an air fryer, the oven ones that have a rotisserie are amazing. Then it's basically subtracting 25 degrees plus 20% of the cook time to be able to cook those things that you normally like in the oven in an air fryer. So doing an Instapot requires a lot more work. So I'm not sure I can explain it in the time lapse, but it is in the cookbook. And I think like the number one tip that I can give succinctly is that where a lot of people go wrong and why they don't enjoy their Instapot is because they think you can just like do 1-to-1 measurements for fluids from a stovetop recipe to the Instapot, not realizing that everything like your veg and your meats are going to add to the liquid content and dilute the flavor of the recipe. So always start with just 1 cup of water, knowing that everything else you add to it that's not a starch is going to add water to the recipe. And then if it's too concentrated for you when it's done, you can always add more water when you're done, but you cannot subtract it when it's over. So it's yeah, so start with 1 cup and increase water at the end if you need to.
In just our last minute or so, a half minute or so, Jules, can you offer some encouragement for people in that place where you were when you weren't able to cook, hadn't found these methods, some encouragement to maybe find ways to give it a try again?
It is daunting and it is difficult, but it's about finding the like little in. If you're not using an Instapot yet or other brand, try that. Finding recipes that are really low prep times, 5-10 minutes prep. And it's difficult. It's one of the things that I talk about is a lot of the recipes that are out there give unrealistic prep times. They'll say, oh, it takes 30 minutes. And where those of us with mobility issues are still chopping vegetables an hour and a half later. So it's go low, go slow, listen to your body is number one. If you need to take breaks, then take a break. Don't push through because that's when things get like painful and ouch, and it just turns into a torture process instead of something that is joyful. And think about ways to you like unconventional ways of cooking. Like if it's easier for you to cook at a table and all you have is your dining room table, create a little cooking prep area at your dining room table and don't use your kitchen unless until it's time to like use your stove.
Jules, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jules Sherrod. We've been talking on Food Friday about his new book. It's called Crip Up the Kitchen: Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. You can find a few recipes from Jules over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Stonehenge, the mysterious site from ancient Britain, attracts tourists and puzzles researchers who try to figure out what it was built and used for. Ongoing research says there may be a sound explanation. As reported by the BBC, it's believed that people use Stonehenge for maybe rituals, ceremonial gatherings. No one knows what they were doing, but ongoing research has analyzed the acoustics of the 5,000-year-old structure. Researchers built a scale model of Stonehenge measured in inches, not feet. They did audio tests and found that the stone arches would have amplified sounds made inside the circle, giving them some cool reverb, too. Now they're putting in figures of people to see how a crowd would have changed the sound. One conclusion, the acoustics would have been great for speeches, ceremonial chanting, or a rock concert. Stonehenge, where the demons dwell, where the banshees live. Acoustical news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the Friday News Roundup. Find out how the last-minute scramble to avoid a default played out. Also, why are parts of California now uninsurable? And what's behind the decision by Texas lawmakers to impeach the state's attorney general? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, state lawmakers have less than a month to finish drafting Wisconsin's next biennial budget, and the powerful Joint Finance Committee hasn't released the full plan on changes to K-12 school funding. School districts around the state are waiting to see what their general revenue is going to look like for the following school year. COVID-19 federal aid is set to run out this year, and the previous two school years provided no increase in per-pupil revenue for public schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the state boost funding for public education? How are changes in enrollment affecting your local school districts? Have you had a vote for local school funding? How did it come out in your community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nick Ouellette is superintendent of the Hudson School District and board president for the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with that federal pandemic relief aid that's ending this year. I know at least some districts have kind of counted on that. How do you see that affecting school districts here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so over the last 2 years, the federal pandemic aid, we were required to use that as our normal funding increases from the state. So for the last 2 years, the state said, hey, you have federal money coming in. We're not going to give you additional spendable money. So use that federal money. And so we've been using that federal money for the last 2 years to kind of make ends meet. And now here we are heading into the next biennium budget, kind of wondering where are we at with that, because that money's one-time money. It's come, it's gone, it's been spent. So really looking at, you know, where do we go from here? Because you kind of have to backfill the one-time money. And then also, how do we move forward with new spending?
Before we get into what you're hoping to see from the state legislature, I mean, it's June. Schools start, you know, September-ish, right? That's a couple of months off. How does that affect you as an administrator trying to make a plan for the upcoming school year?
Yeah, it's a real challenge for us because our fiscal year actually starts July 1. And so we start working, you know, we start actually into a budget that we're not even 100% sure what our revenues are going to be for the year. And so, you know, we're pretty conservative in our estimates and we, you know, try to be pretty conservative in our spending until we get that final approval from the state to really know what our budget picture is going to look like. It's a challenge for us. It's a challenge for all districts across the state. It's something we have to deal with every 2 years.
Now, people may be familiar with the impact of inflation as they go to the store. How does that affect schools and their budgets?
That's exactly right. So we're not immune to inflation like anybody else. So, you know, we have the same wage pressures that private employers have as we try to hire staff, because there's been tremendous wage pressure with low unemployment, both at our hourly staff, but then at our certified staff, our teaching staff. One of the things that's been a real challenge for us, to be quite honest with you, in the last few years, is we're now having to compete with the private sector for employees. We're seeing more and more folks that are leaving teaching to go into the private sector. So really, that used to not be much of a problem for us. But most, you know, a lot of districts are reporting that we're now having to compete with the private sector as far as for employees, which creates some real challenges for our budget when you have this type of inflation and everything else going on.
Yeah, who's getting hit hardest by that? Because I remember, you know, pre-COVID, I was talking to schools around the state where, especially, you know, there might be rural schools who couldn't get that science teacher, that special ed teacher, the shop teacher, even in some cases. Who's being hit by the staffing issues the hardest?
You know, I think it's pretty universal across the state and really across the country. It's going to continue to be a challenge for us. There are fewer and fewer people going into education in college as a major, which is creating fewer graduates in that field, which is tightening up the market. Just for example, 10 years ago, an open elementary education position, teaching position for us, we may generate 300 or 400 applicants for a job like that. Right now, we're lucky to, you know, generate 20. 25 applicants, and people will say, well, that seems like that plenty for a job like that. Well, if in Hudson, which we're really close to a major metro area here up by the Twin Cities, we're getting those kind of applicants. But when you get into rural parts of Wisconsin, they may not even get any applicants for some of those positions. And that's really a challenge for them.
Talking to Nick Ouellette, superintendent of the Hudson School District, board president for the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators, looking at education spending in the state budget. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences if you work at the schools. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's look at some of the budget items. We talked a little bit about sort of the general purpose revenue for schools. Mental health services. Governor Evers had $235 million in his budget to promote mental health services in schools. That was removed, along with a lot of other stuff, by Republicans on joint finance. That doesn't mean some of it won't come back. Can you talk about what that kind of targeted mental health spending means for schools?
Yeah, I believe, you know, we've had conversations with our local legislators. I believe they are going to be putting money back in the budget for mental health. And so I don't think it's lost. Mental health funding is definitely needed. You know, one of the most alarming things we have going on right now is the rate of incidence of mental health issues with some of our littlest learners coming to us, first grade, kindergarten, second grade, that are having, you know, mental health issues that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, even 10 years ago, we weren't having to deal with or see. But one of the bigger issues, even more so than the funding associated with it, is, especially for rural Wisconsin, is trying to find providers to provide those services. And so really trying to look at how can we incentivize to get more people into the mental health industry and things along those lines so we can get more providers in the pipeline. Because a lot of times, you know, we will want to spend money or need to spend money on certain things, and we just cannot provide providers to provide those services for our kids.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Perry is with us in Oconto. Perry, hello.
Yes. I'm really disappointed in the Republican Party not being able to fund making Wisconsin better for everyone in Wisconsin. And that includes the school districts, broadband and mental health and clean water. So that's just my comment, and I hope people realize that when they go to the election booth.
Perry, thanks for the call. Nick, we don't have a final plan yet. Are you worried that there won't be any kind of increase? It sounds like you're counting or assuming that joint finance is going to at least have some kind of funding that you're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty confident, and through conversations with our local legislators, that there will be some money coming our way, K-12 education, specifically related to mental health, but also just in general revenue for us to be able to spend. I think they realize that, we have the same pressures as everybody else. We have wage pressure, like we said, inflationary pressure on buying supplies and utilities and everything else. We need some additional dollars coming that way. And just how much is enough or how much is reasonable, you know, that's in the eye of the beholder, I guess, at this point.
Thanks for that call, Perry. Nick, one other part of the school funding formula, of course, we haven't talked about yet, local property taxes. Schools, districts going to the voters and asking for an increase in a couple of different ways. This last election cycle saw a dip in the number of approvals after they've been going up, as I understand it, over the course of a handful of years. What are you seeing when schools go to the voters for that local boost?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, school districts have had to consistently go back to operational levies in order to make ends meet. We went for an operational levy even in Hudson here, and it failed 53-47 as far as the vote. So we'll have to look at going back with the revamped plan. But I get it. I understand. People feel like they're already paying too much in taxes and it's hard to continue to raise their own taxes. You know, it is a challenge. I get it. But, certain services people have become accustomed to and expect out of their public schools. And in order for us to deliver those services, we need to be able to have money to do that. And that's a big challenge for us. I think you're seeing more and more districts that are having to go to operational levy. And some of them may be doing it a little preemptively because they know it might take one or two or three bites at the apple before they can pass that levy. And they don't want to get to the point where they're having, you know, they don't pass it and they have to make massive cuts to their staffing, which has a negative impact on kids.
Talking to Nick Ouellette from the Hudson School District, superintendent there. He's also board president for the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators. We're looking at state funding for schools as we go through the state budget process for the next couple of years, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a particular need for the school in your community, whether you're a concerned citizen, a parent, a student yourself, or you work at that school? What do you need? What would you like to see state lawmakers and the governor do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Nick Ouellette, Hudson School District Superintendent, Board President for the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 as we look at school funding in the midst of the state budget process. What would you like to know about the costs of operating a school district? What goes into those local budgets? What would you like to see from state lawmakers and the governor when it comes to school funding? What does your community school need? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Nick, I know we've seen some enrollment declines across the state in public schools. A Wisconsin Policy Forum report says 30,000 students fewer since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. How is declining enrollment affecting schools?
Yeah, declining enrollment is definitely a challenge, and it's actually a challenge across the state, across the country, because birth rates are down, and they've been down for quite some time. They've never really rebounded since the 2008 recession. And so one of the big challenges, I try to explain as simple as possible, is if I have four classroom teachers in fourth grade in one of my elementary schools, and they all have 27 kids in each class, and then the next year, that fourth grade has 25 kids in each class, and there's still four teachers, I'm down eight students in fourth grade, yet that revenue, which is close to $100,000, is gone, but I don't have the ability to reduce the expenses because I can't go down to three teachers. I have to keep four because three teachers would be 35 kids, 33 kids per class. And so what happens with school districts is, although yes, there's declining enrollment, and yes, school districts do make adjustments to their staffing, it's not as easy as saying, well, you lost 20 kids this year, you should be able to reduce two or three teachers in relation to that, because it could be 20, 30 kids across 50 different classrooms. And so that's the big challenge. And it's not unique to Hudson. All the school districts have those challenges. And so you have to be able to still get some additional revenue in there in order to maintain your expenses that are somewhat fixed.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Fort Atkinson. Jim, hi.
Hi. What I'm calling about is the SB 301 proposal, which has within it a no law for any advisory referendums. Now, I don't know how much that affects schools, but I mean, I'm not sure what the legal thing is for advisory referendum. But if this means the people in the state of Wisconsin cannot have a referendum and find out what people want around the state, what they're interested in, what they want to spend money on, if SB 301 stops that from happening as a law, I think that could seriously hurt education.
Jim, thanks for the call. I think it's an important distinction, Nick. As you mentioned, this is about advisory referenda. That, as I understand it, doesn't include the kind of school funding referenda we were talking about earlier.
That is correct. So that would be the type of advisory referendums that, you know, the state government or sometime local governments put on ballots to get feedback on something, versus when we go for funding referendums, whether it be for capital projects or operational, there's very specific language. That bill that's in the House would not impact those at all.
Jim, thanks a lot for calling at 800-642-1234. Nick, we see in the news fairly often, you know, some heated political debates springing up at school board meetings in districts around the state, around the country on contentious issues. But we see polls that show, I think, a fair amount of support and trust in schools, not universal. Are you hearing these kind of things from other administrators in the state where they're seeing these heated moments coming up in their meetings and their interactions with the public?
Yeah, I think in general, it's not unique to school board meetings or anything like that. That I think, you know, we've got a much more volatile political climate than we've had in a long time, and people feel very strongly about their side of issues, and so yeah, I would say that, you know, we are seeing that more and more often. We are seeing, things that typically haven't been very divisive have become extremely divisive issues, and it is a real challenge to manage, because it's, you know, people feel very passionate about things, and we try to remind people that, you know, for the vast majority of things, we have much more in common on both sides of the issues, regardless of what the issue is, than we have differences. And so continually looking for that common ground on a lot of things is important. But I would say, yes, it's been a much more challenging environment in school districts in dealing with, you know, strong opinions on both sides of any issue. Neither side has a total monopoly on the high ground there. We tend to get beat up on both sides of any issue just about all the time.
Talking to Nick Ouellette, superintendent of the Hudson School District, board president at the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators, looking at financial issues, funding issues facing schools around the state as lawmakers work on the two-year budget for Wisconsin. Still time for you to join in. What does your local school district need? 800-642-1234 is the number. Go back to your calls now. Marty is with us in Lake Geneva. Marty, hello.
Good afternoon. So let's digress a bit to the comments about lesser children. So let's say if there was 100 children last year and now there's 90 kids. Unless those 10 families left the state, aren't you still getting the same revenue from property taxes to go toward that? And if so, wouldn't you end up with a surplus? Unless I'm missing something, and I'll listen to your response off air.
Marty, thanks a lot for the call. And this is another great clarification. Marty's talking about the property tax, the local property tax that goes to the schools, but there's that per pupil funding that's coming from the state, Nick.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And so really what it is you have to look at it in the aggregate, you know, the overall district number. So you could have some grades that are up and some grades that are down, but overall, you know, our funding is tied to the total number of students in the district. And so one of the challenges can be, I gave you the example about fourth graders, that fourth grade classroom. It could be that fourth grade then moved on to fifth grade. And previously we only had three sections of fifth grade, but now we need to have four sections because it's a bigger class. And so that kind of funding goes with them. So all of those, there's just a lot of different components that go into it. And I know districts are trying to cut back expenses. It's just not quite as cut and dry as people would like to think. Okay, yeah, for every $100,000 of lost revenue you have, you can just, you know, reduce staffing. And you have to remember, staffing is our biggest cost. About 85% of our budget is in staffing because we're in the people business, and that's what we do. So, you know, it is a big challenge for us. And then I think the other thing people have to remember is when it comes to the property tax piece, yeah, even people that have kids at home and their kids graduate and go off to college, they're still paying property tax. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that about 70% of people that live in a school district, they don't have any kids in the actual school district. They don't work for us. They don't have, and that's pretty common in most districts across state. They don't work for us. They don't have kids that go to our schools. Their biggest connection to the school district is that they pay the bill. And, you know, we need to be cognizant of that and obviously try to be good stewards of that money. But whether their kids leave or stay, they're going to still continue to pay property taxes. It's a complicated formula that the state's put together. But the biggest challenge is our overall net amount. When that doesn't grow, it makes it harder for us.
Thanks for that call, Nick. In just our last minute or so, we've covered a lot of ground. Any other priorities as you watch the progress of the state budget?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a couple of big priorities, you know, trying to get per pupil increases, but also our reimbursement on special education spending is about 29%. So that means every dollar that we spend on special education, we get reimbursed about 29 cents. And so we're just trying to get that reimbursement up to about 60 cents on the dollar, because whatever we don't get reimbursed, that has to come from our general fund for those additional services. And so that's a big push. The special ed funding is a big push. It would help all districts across the state because all districts run deficits as it relates to educate our kids with disabilities. We want to do it. We expect to do it. We welcome to do it. It's just some kids need a lot of services, and we just need the financial resources to be able to educate them. It's very important to us. I think the last piece I would leave you with is we need some level of surety or clarity for long-term planning. And so I think, you know, the sooner we can kind of understand what the budget looks like, the better off we'll be. And if they can do some things, put some long-term mechanisms in place so that, you know, we kind of have a little bit of an idea of what our revenues are going to be moving forward, that would be greatly appreciated. I know that's very difficult. And I also know that we're not the only part of the state government that needs funding. And so we're well aware of it. We just know that we're in kind of a tough spot right now. We could use a little additional help.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
That's Nick Ouellette, Hudson School District Superintendent and Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators Board President. We've been talking about budget priorities for public education. Coming up Monday on Central Time, it can feel like government is caught in partisan gridlock, but it doesn't have to be that way. Find out why with the author of the book, Bridge Builders, How Government Can Transcend Boundaries to Solve Big Problems. That's Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we take a look at the first ever national strategy to fight anti-Semitism, which the White House released last week. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.